Welcome back to the Medical Illustration Podcast. This is your host, Paul Kelly, and I am reporting to you from Toronto, Canada, at the culmination of the American Association of Anatomy 2024 Anatomy Connected Conference. This was an exciting and enriching event I'd been looking forward to. We had a number of AMI colleagues in town from all over the globe, some giving presentations, others just hanging out like myself. So it was really nice to reconnect with them. Some of these folks I hadn't seen since before the pandemic. I was also psyched to get exposure to this new group of kindred spirits. The AAA consists of academic professors and researchers, those teaching anatomy and conducting research in the field, and students and practitioners of the anatomical sciences. It started out with a snowy weekend here in Toronto, so the genuine Canadian experience for all conference attendees. The theme of this year's meeting was visualization in anatomy, and they definitely delivered on that. I'm going to report on as many aspects of the conference as I can. I'll share some notes that I took on the talks that I attended, but I want to mention there were a lot of concurrent sessions, so unfortunately this is just a small part of the conference, and I won't be able to cover everything I saw and heard, but I wanted to share this experience with my audience, bring awareness to this organization, and encourage everyone to consider attending the next Anatomy Connected Conference. On the evening of Friday, the 22nd of March, 2024, the event kicked off with a plenary session by Dr. Kurt Schwenk from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at University of Connecticut, who presented on using microvideography to study precise movements of lizards in capturing prey. This is a good place to point out that the work of anatomists can span a wide range of species, not just humans. Kurt worked as a zookeeper in Brooklyn, New York, while pursuing his PhD. His focus more recently has been on the lizard tongue. This was a high-speed anatomy in motion presentation. Really cool and presented with lots of histological images from the lab and high-speed video clips. So you could see these unique tongues composed of pure muscle tissue taking on dimensional changes with conservation of volume throughout complex motions for prey capture. The line of study looked into the biological adhesive qualities and unique structural qualities such as the hexagonal shape of the tongue papillae, allowing for maximum packing. We got to see the chameleon tongue bedewed with viscous secretion, changing shape before it even contacted its prey. Pretty wild stuff. Right after that, we had a mixer where it was a social event, got to shake hands with some people, meet some new people, and that was a lot of fun. I thought it was a great way to kick off the conference. Now, before attending this conference, I noted in the program that AI was a feature in many presentations. These began on Saturday morning with a panel discussion, a set of presentations from Patrick Penfather, assistant professor for theater and film at the University of British Columbia. He was quite enthusiastic about the prospects for AI and shared some of his personal journey, which included early investigations into fish movement patterns. Interestingly enough, I've actually heard of people talk about that before as being a useful application for these kinds of tools. His motivations were to investigate the process of developing technology that solves a human problem. So we need to identify problems to solve, and then we can identify generative AI as a potential solution if we understand the challenges, which include the complexity of science, the potential for misinformation bias, of course, data privileges, hallucinations of the AI, and public skepticism. He concluded with a recommended actionable item, which was to spend more time and focus on data organization, which I thought was interesting because metadata is something leaders in our field, such as Tonya Hines, have been encouraging for quite a while now, so I definitely see how that would translate into our field. Next up, we had Michael Hickman, one of my former podcast guests from the Barrow Neurological Institute in Arizona, presenting on navigating AI in medical illustration, some considerations. I appreciate the candid nature of Michael's talk. He started right off at the get-go talking about the concern of undercutting the market in pricing. I mean, let's get right to it. We are now looking at a situation where low cost and high volumes will start to become the norm. Michael encouraged more partnerships with medical illustrators because we as medical illustrators have been able to navigate massive sweeping changes in our industry that were analogous to current AI concerns. Current and previous generations of medical illustrators went through a revolution with medical photography. This was something another one of my former guests, Mesa Schumacher, commented on. where we went through a shift where we were no longer responsible or needed to document things because we had come up with technology that could document things faster and more efficiently, essentially photography and video. So our role shifted more into interpretation, simplification, distilling information, and depicting what cannot be seen. The next big revolution in medical illustration was the move to digital, where traditional media now had to take a back seat to tools that allowed for endless undo actions, filters, color corrections, layers, and incredible degrees of control, and of course, repurposing of assets. Most recently, the field of medical illustration has integrated 3D models and animation as a new forefront of our technological toolkit. So as we continue to adjust to changes in the tools used for image creation, we have learned to lean in more to one of our superpowers, which is our ability to design and depict new subject matter and things that have never been previously visualized. This is something that AI is still not really able to do very well, as generative AI is based on essentially remixing already existing content that has been scraped from the internet. This segues into the ethics concerns of using AI. We do have some options. There are tools such as Glaze, which acts as a protective measure, adding a barely a discernible filter over images, which will make them difficult to detect and categorize by AI scraping algorithms. Nightshade is a more offensive tool, impairing AI generative models' ability to create images by essentially poisoning a dataset. From their website, Nightshade's goal is to not break models, but to increase the cost of training on unlicensed data, such that licensing image from the creators becomes a viable alternative. Ultimately, I do think the option most of us will opt in for is the so-called ethical AI models, such as Adobe Firefly, which are paid services, but are designed for reimbursing artists for their contributions to a dataset. It's also worth noting that as biomedical communicators and scientific visualizers, we have an awareness and familiarity with the medical terminology that is used in our work. This may include some words that are restricted from use in publicly open generative art models, such as Midjourney, which do have a degree of censorship over certain terms. I thought Michael did a great job of laying all this out for us to think about. The next speaker on this panel was Sean Seong Hyun Jeon, product manager at UBC Hive, speaking on AI as a tool in anatomy education. He began by pointing out that while large language models, which have been fed massive amounts of data, have become a cause of concern, if we take a step back and think about when Google first came out, we also had a fear of what that was going to mean to our jobs and humans' ability to keep pace. What we need to ask, though, is why? Why are we using these tools? Why are we concerned? Why are they a good option? Sean shared a helpful acronym for interfacing with AI tools. THINK, THINK. Is what this tool telling me true? Is it helpful? Is it inspiring? Is it necessary? And is it kind? He also shared an important observation I think we should all be keeping in mind with AI generative tools, which is a Western bias in a lot of what we're seeing in both the images and in the text generated. These tools have been developed in the United States. I think there's, of course, going to be a bias there, and we need to be aware of this. He closed in making the point that ultimately the teacher is more important than the tool or the tech, and I would definitely agree with him there. The next speaker was Bailey Lowe from the Biomedical Visualization Communications Program at UBC, who is also a fellow podcaster, I might add, speaking about generative AI in science communication. She was speaking from a learning experience designer perspective, making connections between pedagogy and technology. She started off with saying that our problem statements need to come before our solutions, and I couldn't agree more. I was also happy to hear this theme repeated throughout the conference. This has been my sentiment as well, as it's great when we have new features and tools that come out, but if it's not solving a problem that I started with, it's not necessarily useful. Bailey also echoed Sean's observations that there is a lack of diverse inputs in the AI models, and equity is never addressed as a computational problem. Some suggested use cases for AI included building rough drafts, coding, cost and time estimates for work. I think these are useful applications and similar to the ways in which I've been using tools like ChatGPT recently, although I hadn't thought to use it for cost and time estimates. That's actually kind of a good idea. I think I might try that. But at the end of the day, we need to think about methods and strategies to combat and regulate misinformation. We've already found ourselves in a situation where we're probably seeing AI-generated images fed back into AI art-generated models, which is going to compound inaccuracies. We need to emphasize human compassion Let's choose skeptical curiosity over skeptical criticism. The next session was design thinking, visual communication through the lens of the medical illustrator. This was the AMI-sponsored session, spearheaded by Jill Gregory from the Icahn School of Medicine in New York City. This session began with Chris Smith describing how the Medical Illustrator's Toolkit drives new approaches in anatomical research. Chris is a high-level illustrator from the Johns Hopkins program. He's now a postdoctoral fellow at the Division of Anthropology, American Museum of Natural History in New York, who has recently been digging deep into research on the evolution of the inner ear. Chris began by giving a bit of a background on medical illustration as a field. He talked about our role as visual storytellers and how we create what cannot be seen or what has never been seen. And he also described some of our transformative modalities, which include thinking in 3D, modular approach, and shifting perspective. This really speaks to strong fundamentals in all aspects of visual creation. He also shared an observation from one of his professors, which I thought was particularly useful for everyone in our field. Can someone sculpt what you drew? That's a great question to ask yourself. Chris then went on to speak more about the research he's been doing, in particular regarding the vestibule and semicircular canals of the inner ear apparatus. One takeaway that I got was, I don't think I'd heard of this structure before, the membrana limitans, a membrane lying just inferior to the utricle, providing support and acting as a structural boundary between portions of the vestibule. This structure being involved with balance and orientation. I was blown away by Chris's ability not only to perceive some of these minute structures from scan slices, but also to find clever angles to pose the anatomy so it would be depicted well and clearly for a viewer. Chris would go on to present again later at the conference on Monday. But next up in this session, we had my colleagues from TVA Surge, Joy Chu and Lesha Shitska, presenting on our work at the Toronto Video Atlas of Surgery in Crafting Clarity, How to Tell Complex Surgical Stories. I had the privilege to see this talk come together behind the scenes, and I was equally impressed by the production and delivery. Joy and Lesha spoke about the benefits of the video medium for our subject matter, understanding our target audience, and the role of surgeons in our production process. They went into the art of surgical storytelling, discussing how we enhance shots with video editing and compositing techniques, add clarity with visual cues, and enhance our content with 3D animation. I thought they did an amazing job, and I was happy to see people line up to the mic at the Q&A after their talk. It's always great to hear the feedback from people in the audience who share new insights and perspectives. I always walk away from these conferences with new ideas and questions, and that's what conferences are all about. They give you new considerations and curiosities about work you've been doing for extended lengths of time. So it really is like a mental breath of fresh air. Rounding out the session were Shay Saharan from University of Toronto and Naomi Robson from Bridgeable, presenting Beyond the Books, Exploring the Potential of Design, Interactivity, and Learner-Centered Thinking in Anatomical Education. This was a bit of a different approach in applying the tools and techniques of medical illustrators for what I took to be a user experience design project. They gave an overview of the production process, which I always love to see these depictions, especially when they start to dissect that process a bit. A big focus of this talk was exploring the users and their needs and iteratively evaluating and questioning their own assumptions. So the iterative design approach and revision phases here were not being driven by client preferences or fine-tuning accuracy, but rather fine-tuning the delivery mechanism for maximum effectiveness. Shay and Naomi discussed asking different evaluation questions at different phases. This, I think, does mirror the experience of working with medical content experts, and at different points in production, you have to direct the focus on certain types of revisions because otherwise you're just going to be overwhelmed or you're going to get distracted or not cover what you need to. And so working on content that will only later end up requiring further revisions or omissions. Shay also shared a link for SciViz tips and resources, which I'll include in the show notes. So a beautifully composed group session touching on different aspects of medical illustration, 2D illustrations, 3D linear storytelling, and interactive media experience design, all for different audiences. I was really inspired and incredibly proud to be associated with these folks. After a great lunch with my alumni friends, we headed back for an Embracing AI in Anatomy Education platform session. So as mentioned, AI was a hot topic across the entire conference program. I was so impressed, though, with the measured response to AI throughout this event. I would describe it as optimistic curiosity with cautious evaluation, which is kind of like the approach I myself have been trying to take. I saw throughout the presentations and the QA follow-ups that educators know that their students are going to be using AI tools like ChatGPT, and you know, they, as the educators, the professors are going to have to keep pace with this stuff, but they're also asking the right questions, in my opinion, you know, like such as, what is the problem we are looking to solve here, and how can we instruct students to use these tools effectively but not be reliant on them? Many of the attendees have been in the field of education for a long time, and they've already seen and lived through the explosion of the internet and rapid integration of technology in the classroom. They've seen the advancements, and they've heard a lot of the sales pitches. You know, not every new gadget pans out, but you also can't ignore the rising tides. Now, some of the tips from educators on how best to adjust to AI use in education settings included increased transparency, deciphering of diversity, evaluating uncertainty and variation, educator awareness, encouraging AI free time, and looking for ways to extend human capacity. I think in the future we may see customized lesson plans for individual interests and custom AI models specific to certain education institutions. The Saturday talks concluded with the keynote presentation by Dr. Drew Barry. Dr. Barry has been a fantastic contributor to biomedical animation over many years. In this talk, he revisited some of his greatest hits and shared some of his new projects that he's been working on, which included some pretty massive videos for Omnimax theaters. So he's doing 8K video, 60 frames per second, projected onto dome screens, and I think it was stereoscopic as well. I mean, that's incredible to imagine all the computational power to produce. That's just staggering. He walked us through some of the production process and how they had found a Unity plugin that worked for projecting onto a dome-shaped screen. I think I wasn't the only person to sort of raise an eyebrow at that, because in case you haven't been keeping up with industry trends, Unity has sort of fallen out of favor after they changed their policies, and the Unreal game engine has also become preferable to a lot of gaming and interactive developers because they made that into a freeware model. But Dr. Barry explained that they started making these Omnimax movies before all of that transpired, and their workflow still works, so they've just stuck with it. Drew also spoke about the importance of sound design in his animations. He has a good friend who's been a collaborator with him for a long time and who worked on horror movies, so he's familiar with music and sound effects to evoke strong emotions. Another thing in his presentation I thought was interesting was his focus is on the young adult target population, specifically high school age kids. So I think that's really awesome that he's looking towards the future and making content to inspire the next generation of biological scientists. Speaking of the future of science, I was so impressed with all of the research posters. There was a massive space dedicated to these. I want to give a special shout out to all of those who were traveling to Canada from international destinations. I loved seeing all the anatomical variations, and I was really impressed by some of the illustrations I saw. I also liked how the schedule of this conference was really encouraging of engagement with the poster presenters. A few of note: anatomical variation of hepatic arteries, insights from a 13-year cadaver study in India by Dr. Chitra Ramasay, with whom I got to speak for a few minutes. And in this brief conversation, it really highlighted the importance of pursuing diversity in our medical illustration work, because she pointed out to me that some of the anatomical variations that she was looking at differ in different population groups. So, for example, there was an anatomical variation that was only present in about 60% or less in studies that were done in Western countries like the United States, but this same variation was found in 80% of the cadavers that she was looking at in India. So looking at different population groups will have a direct impact on their clinical care. Another poster I was immediately drawn to was Subscapular Artery Variations and Military Personnel Considerations, a Case Report and Review. I believe I got to speak with Olivia Stacer, the first author on this one, and if I recall correctly, she had done the illustrations as well, which were very good. Just a few posters away was Fibularis Unicus, a singular lateral leg muscle. This was really cool. It's basically a fibularis longus and brevis combined. I think I was speaking with the first author, Alexis Chandler, who's standing by this poster, and we got to talk about that briefly. One poster I thought was super cool was a quadrificating celiac artery. Man, that was awesome. So the common hepatic artery, left gastric artery, splenic artery, and right hepatic artery were all branching from the celiac trunk. That was fascinating. You just don't see that. And of course, I gotta give props to Sarah Glushitz from St. George's University on their poster, study, and accompanying illustration, The Menstrual Cycle, Comparing and Contrasting the Linear and Circular Model Through the Lens of the Medical Illustrator. This one really stood out. Beautiful design and visualizations. So again, I just want to point out this was a tiny fraction of all the posters that were there. I tried my best to have a look at all of them, speak with anyone that I could, and it was so much fun. It was really cool. It was a lot of fun to be able to talk shop with people who speak the same language. I mean, they want to be able to talk with somebody who knows what it is they've done, right? And it was awesome. It was great. I also wanted to note that one of the sessions that I did not attend, but I found to be discussed quite a bit out in the hallways, was entitled, How Far Would You Go for the Perfect Picture? This being about ethical considerations in anatomy education. One of the speakers was Dr. Sabine Hildebrandt from the Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard University Medical School, speaking on anatomy in Nazi Germany and the Pirnkopf Atlas, how the past shines a light on the present and leads to change in the practice of a publisher. I've previously attended this lecture at U of T. It's worth mentioning, though, as I say, because it was notable for many of the people who attended it. It had a very strong impact. And if you're unfamiliar with the history of this atlas, it's definitely worth looking into. You should definitely know it if you're involved in the field of medical illustration. It's pretty rough, man. I mean, it's really awful, tough stuff to get through, but it's important history to know about. I'm going to include a link to a previous lecture by Dr. Hildebrandt in the show notes. So on Sunday, March 24th, I was back early in the morning for another educational platform session. I should mention that a lot of the focus of the talks at this event were on curriculum design. Understandably so, you know, as this was an academic conference of anatomy educators. This manifested in several ways. A lot of the talks were focused around learning activities, comparing learning outcomes and assessments. You know, these educators are constantly asking themselves questions such as, what is the essential anatomical knowledge that needs to be taught? And what is the clinical application of anatomy? I wanted to point out that this was a major focus, as you'll soon see. The first set of talks I attended on Sunday morning was the educational session, which began with a surgical skills training presentation. Dr. Danielle Brewer DeLuce from McMaster University compared human and pig models and different embalming fluid types, which I hadn't heard of before, but I guess you've got to do that when you're running a university-level course on dissection, and you have to take these things into account. So they compared four different embalming fluids, looking at mechanical wear and tear testing and preservation of visual appearance. There was a presentation from Dr. Nathan Toulos from the University of Mississippi Medical Center comparing photogrammetry with the WIDAR app scanning method. This is an app that uses your cell phone camera, the motivation for this, of course, being decreased time for lab and lecture. The presenter had experience with manual methods of photogrammetry using Metashape and Blender. When comparing the results, they found that the photo time to be roughly the same, but the WIDAR app produced models much faster and also with smaller file sizes, which made it easier to embed these model files into a PowerPoint, which, to be honest, I didn't realize you could do, but that's pretty cool. I'm definitely going to have to try that out. Next up, Eduardo Muscogliotti from Hull York Medical School presented a framework for high-quality educational anatomy video production. He shared the YouTube quality assessment metrics, comparing two videos on hip joint anatomy, one using a YouTube quality assessment checklist and the other without. Both videos were about 12 minutes in length, shot with the same equipment, one presented by himself and the other presented with his twin brother, which made for a unique twist on ensuring an adequate control group. They found that post-test results were higher for students who had viewed the video with YouTube quality assessment, and that video also had higher YouTube views over time. I think he did note that that's probably because YouTube was more likely to recommend that video that was in line with their guidelines, not necessarily because it was better, but the point stands. If you know the requirements and standards of the platform you're using, it's going to make an impact on viewership. And on that note, I would ask YouTube to make these quality assessment standards a little bit easier to find, because when I went searching for them, they weren't readily available. I'm not sure why they would not want those to be front and center. But anyway, I'm going to move on to a bit of the other sessions. My apologies for speakers I'm skipping over, but I have to give credit to the AAA for including not just one, but at least two sessions that I saw that were focused on the reporting of and the reflections on failure. This was really refreshing, and I kind of felt therapeutic. I think this was a great idea to include in a conference. You know, to be honest, I sometimes forget that imposter syndrome is prevalent in all walks of life, not just for medical illustrators. I think for us, it feels kind of prominent because you can so easily and readily compare your work with someone else's. But this is also true for people publishing papers and teaching classes. One presenter I saw, Dr. David Morton of the Noted Anatomist YouTube channel, talked about comparing ourselves to other people and their accomplishments and having to keep that in check. I think social media can be a real trigger for this for many people. He recommended, you know, using those feelings of self-consciousness and imposter syndrome as indicators to seek out learning, observe what others are doing and take cues from them, and look for opportunities to collaborate. I like the quote he capped off his session with: "Humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking less about yourself." Definitely words to live by. Now, for the advanced 3D imaging modalities session later that day, there was one that stood out to me that I wanted to mention. This was a talk by Dr. Mei Zhen, professor of molecular genetics at the University of Toronto, on the neuronal development of C. elegans, widely considered to be an ideal species for research, and she explains why. This tiny worm only has 300 neurons in its adult state. This makes it very reasonable to get a grasp on what each cell in this organism is doing through different stages of development. In her research, Dr. Zhen showed how they were able to observe rewiring events converting axons to dendrites and dendrites to axons, meaning that neuronal signaling actually reverses direction over the course of time, and she described this process as a gradual transition of mixed identity with perfect spatial coordination. I thought this was incredible. I also thought she had a beautiful hero image for the start of her talk and several simple and effective animations showing just, you know, a few nerve cells. I can honestly say I have never been so excited and fascinated by C. elegans before. Later on Sunday, I attended another education platform session. Kayla Viano presented approaches for and outcomes of anatomical variation in gross anatomy courses across degree programs, a scoping review. Anatomical variations being commonly related to medical errors. An explicit approach to presenting these is preferable to implicit. Explicit in this context meaning a more structured educational framework with learning timelines and objectives. As was mentioned in a lot of these talks, contact hours in anatomy in medical education are declining, so they have to balance a focus on anatomical variance within time constraints. Next in this session was Decoding DPT Anatomy Education Trends in the U.S., A Journey into Student Satisfaction, Innovative Teaching, and the Power of Cadaver Virtual Fusion, with Alexandra Chavez, a doctoral PT student in Fresno, California. The U.S. apparently has 14,000 new physical therapy jobs per year, and more movement experts are needed. There's no universal guidelines. A lot of the time and tools vary for training. Cadavers with or without virtual tools were tested, and there was a preference for kinesiology students over text to have access to these resources. There was increased satisfaction with cadaveric studies or a combination structure. The significance of satisfaction being correlated with motivation and a positive emotional state impacts learning retention. The last talk I'm going to mention is Benefits of Autopsy-Based Prosection for Gross Anatomy Labs in a Clinically Integrated Medical Curriculum by Dr. Chelsea Lohman. Very cool. So this was looking at using autopsy-based prosections for anatomy labs. They had produced what they called a mega block, which were full visceral removals en bloc from a cadaver, all internal organs combined into one large prosection. They did a study with a fall semester group using the autopsy teaching approach, and then in the spring semester, a regional control group. Participant written exam results were roughly identical, but on practical exam results, the experimental group did better. On Monday morning, I jumped out of bed early yet again to attend an imaging platform session. These included sorting signal from noise, simulating 3D morphology with Slicer Morph and Advanced Normalization Tools, or ANTS, by Dr. Rachel Rosten from Seattle Children's Research Institute, pre-weaning craniofacial development in mice with osteogenesis imperfecta by Courtney Miller from University of North Texas Health Science Center. I learned that during early development, skull bones grow at different rates. Next, I saw statistical shape modeling to differentiate the symptomatic and asymptomatic hip in bilateral CAM FAI, or camshaft femoacetabular impingement, from Cassidy Fu from Western Ontario University. Evaluation of a novel denervation technique to relieve lower back pain, a cadaveric feasibility pilot study, was presented by Charlotte Jones Whitehead, also of Western University. I didn't realize that 80% of people experience lower back pain at some point in their lives, 15 to 45% of which is related to osteoporosis. Common treatment is radiofrequency ablation, medial spinal nerves being the targets. Finally, pathophysiology after spinal cord injury is non-uniform along the GI tract by Jackson Radler of Penn State College of Medicine, and we've got your back, quantifying sublaminar ridge with CT scan reconstructions by Olivia Chung from McMaster. At the final education platform session of the conference, which included short presentations on drawing, augmented reality, and 3D printing, one that stood out to me the most was the impact of a novel interactive medical imaging curriculum presented by Aaron Fillmore. Familiarity with and the ability to interpret medical imaging is considered an essential clinical skill for its ability to visualize hidden anatomy. It's considered the foundation of safe and effective medical practice and the language of contemporary medicine. Yet there is a lack of standards in medical imaging training. The problems faced include finding time in the curriculum, availability of staff, image sets and technology, various experience levels of professors, and student buy-in. The research proposed a medical imaging curriculum which integrated into medical school during all phases of training, with the end goal to increase students' competency to assess and apply medical imaging knowledge. Students reported it helped them visualize and understand anatomy and conceptualize relationships, and also exposed weak areas in their clinical knowledge. It challenged students to visualize anatomy in applied ways, gave them confidence to use imaging in clinical settings, made imaging more approachable, took away the mystery, and required them to learn in ways that best suited them. The take-home of this study were that imaging should be always included in medical school curriculum, and it was best administered within small groups. I spoke with a few of my industry colleagues about different approaches to getting the most out of conference experiences, and I'd love to hear my listeners' thoughts on this too. So please do comment on this show whenever you find it and let me know, you know, how do you get the most out of conferences? Personally, I think it's fun to try and meet new people and support the work of students. I spoke with a lot of different folks at the mixer at the end of the first night. I also made it a point throughout the whole weekend to walk around and check out the posters and talk with researchers, find out more about their work. But, you know, I also think it's okay to hang back and digest the setting at your own pace. I like to take notes usually at conferences, and this time around, it really motivated me to do something with those notes. So that's why I'm doing this podcast, because I wanted to put those notes to good use. In some of the talks, presenters asked people not to take photos, and I always respect that. But otherwise, I often do take photos of slides because it's just too fast of a pace a lot of the time for me to jot down notes. And this way I can kind of look back on those and remember what was covered. So I usually have both methods going at the same time. A notebook is also good for jotting down ideas that come to me, or, you know, even some doodles occasionally. And hey, saving on your cell phone's battery life as well. Well, my cell phone was definitely floating around 1% when I departed early Monday evening. As I left the venue to make my way home, I noted the brief snowfall that had greeted us on Friday had melted off completely, and a warm spring sun was shining brightly through the towers of downtown Toronto, gently blinding me as I made my way to the subway. But it didn't bother me. My mind was already ablaze with deep thoughts. I really enjoyed the Anatomy Connected conference for a lot of different reasons, but especially because of the kinship that I felt with the people there. It's really nice to feel like you belong in a place. It's nice to strike up a conversation with a total stranger and already know you're gonna have things to contribute, and you're gonna wanna know what they have to say. And you know that you really do wanna know more about what this person is into. I know a lot of us have a comfort zone and, you know, where we're productive and we need to brace solace to accomplish our goals. But if the best possible outcome of what AI proponents comes true, and these tools really do free us up from otherwise tedious, monotonous tasks and give us all this extra free time, I think it's worth asking, what is our plan for all that extra time we've opened up for ourselves? What would you do with that? Well, maybe this is something we need to think about more. You know, what's our end goal? What do we want to free ourselves up to do? I'd like to hope that we all make more time to connect with our fellow humans. We make time to listen to what other people have to say and give more people an opportunity to share their wisdom and knowledge. I experienced all these things at the AAA meeting, and I walked away feeling a little more curious and a little more connected. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Medical Illustration Podcast. Until next time, be well, my friends.